consistency. So if you look at the lesson, if you're joining us right now on YouTube, there's a link to these notes right underneath in the description. And if you're joining us on Facebook, you want to go to gracelifebiblechurch.com, click on the link for lesson 132 under recent sermons, and then you can access these notes that I have displayed right now on the monitor. So let's get right into the introduction here. So we began our study of the 1560 Complete Geneva Bible in lesson 128 by looking at its production and influence. So we looked at how it came about, the production of it, the printing of it, the influence that it had, and we will revisit a few of those points when we conclude our conversation about the Geneva Bible. But more recently, in lessons 129 through 131, we looked at the Old Testament of the 1560 Geneva Bible. Now, the reason why we spent so much time on that topic, that would be specifically the Old Testament, is because the Geneva Bible marked the first time that the entire Old Testament had been made available in English via, and this should say translation, I believe, via translation of the whole Hebrew text. So we made a lot of comments in the past about Tyndale and the portions that Tyndale was able to translate before he died. But the 1560 Geneva Bible is the entire Old Testament from Hebrew, okay? It includes the sections that Tyndale had previously done, plus all the sections that he was not able to finish before he was martyred. Moreover, in the readings where King James translators did not follow the bishop's Bible, they used readings furnished by the Geneva Bible in the majority of these instances. Consequently, it's important to observe the close connection between the Geneva and King James Old Testaments. So again, I've talked to you about this again. I'm going to lay this out in much more detail when we get there. But rule number one given to the King James translators was to follow the bishop's Bible unless the truth of the original determined otherwise. In the instances where they did not follow the bishop's Bible, statistically, more often than not, they used a Geneva reading instead of a reading that was in the bishop's. So that is why, critical reason why this Bible is so important, all right? So let's get right then into the New Testament. So please recall in lessons 125, 126, and 127, we looked at the 1557 Geneva New Testament. The Geneva translators published 3 years later in 1560 a slight revision of their previous New Testament text from 1557. Regarding the 1560 revised Geneva New Testament, David Daniel, author of the Bible in English, Its History and Influence, states the following. So before I read the quote, let me just say something about that, all right? So we know that in 1557, from Geneva, they did a what? A New Testament, alright? 3 years later, in 1560, they're going to translate the entire Bible, alright? So, the entire Bible is going to be included in this 1560 Geneva Bible. So, you can see then that, I mean, so the New Testament that is contained in this 1560 Geneva Bible is only 3 years removed from the one from 1557, right? So only 3 years are separating these. So there's not a ton of difference between them because they had just done it a few years earlier, okay? So the 1560 New Testament is going to be a slight revision of what they had already done in 1557. So let's look at this quote. So it's this quote right here. The text of the 1560 New Testament was a careful revision, no doubt, by Whittingham himself of that prepared by him in 1557. Now with slightly more attention to Beza's Latin text of 1556, but still closely following Tyndale. To illustrate the level of revision, the chief changes in the 1560 to the passage from Luke 2, see notes from lesson 126, so we already looked at that and we'll look at it again here in a minute, alright, are in verse 41, his parents went, so there's a change, his parents and of Passover, which we'll look at here in a minute, verse 43, and his, and had finished the days thereof, remained, and Joseph knew not his mother, and Joseph knew not nor his mother. Verse 56, and it came to pass 3 days after, verse 49, knew yet not. For this passage, the 1560 New Testament keeps all of the 1557 notes, merely reducing the first references to that from Deuteronomy. Okay, so I'll explain what all that means, all right? So let's look at what he's talking about. So if you look at the next point, I'm going to show you exactly what he's talking about. All right, so to understand the citation more clearly from Professor Daniel, please consider the following table comparing the 1557 and 1560 Geneva renderings of Luke chapter 2, verses 40 through 52. Okay, so here's what we have. We're going to use a format that we've used before to look at this. All right? On the left-hand column, you have the Geneva New Testament from 1557. In the right-hand column, you have the Geneva New Testament from 1560. Anything that is underlined in the column for 1560 indicates a change from the previous one. Okay, so just again to point out the obvious here, these are only 3 years removed from each other, right? So unless they found something that they thought was like a gross error or something along those lines, should we expect to see relative similarity between what they did in 1557 and what they did in 1560? But we need to look at exactly what we're dealing with here, okay? So let's start with verse 40. So you guys have this in front of you in your printed notes, but I also have it up here on the screen, right? So look at verse 40 from the 1557. And the child grew and waxed strong in spirit and was filled with wisdom, and the grace of God was with him. So Sylvia brought this up. You'll see that, are they using the ampersand here, the and sign? So let's go here now to the 1560. And the child grew and. So I noted that as a change, because they drop the sign for and, the symbol for and actually put the word and where? In the text, okay? I just marked it as a change because it is a change in the... It's a change, it's not a substantive change, it's a change in the way the text appears, right? Here you have just a symbol indicating and here you have the actual word what? And, alright? So let's look at verse 40 in the 1560. And the child grew and waxed strong in spirit and was filled with wisdom, and the grace of God was with him. Now, we should also underline that I forgot, we should underline the S on spirit. So you'll notice that there's a capitalization on spirit here that there wasn't here. Now that could be substantive. Right? Because if you capitalize spirit, you seem to be indicating now the third member of the Godhead, the Holy Spirit, right? So there is a change there that I overlooked when I went through this. So again, let me just make a brief disclaimer. When you're comparing stuff like this, if you look, after a while, your eyes kind of go sideways, okay? So if I miss one, you let me know, and we'll make sure that we add it to the corrected copy of the notes, all right? So let's go to verse 41. So 1557, verse 41. And his father and mother went to Jerusalem every year at the feast of Easter. Okay? Verse 41. Now his parents went to Jerusalem every year at the feast of what? Passover. Okay, so this marks the first time, the 1560 occurrence of Passover here marks the first time that the word Passover is used in the New Testament text of the English Bible to refer to the Jewish feast. All right? Previous to this, it had always been referred to as what? Easter. And we went through a whole study on that. I've written a whole book about that, right? So we do see some changes here. Notice that, and his father and mother, just is now shortened to what? His parents went to Jerusalem every year at the feast of what? Passover. Okay, so there's a few changes there in verse 41. So don't turn off of page one yet. But so you're looking down here, right? Let's just go up a little bit, and I just want to point this out to you, right? So in this quote, Professor Daniel, notice in verse 41 he talked about his parents went and of what?
Passover.
So in that quote, what is he talking about? He's talking about those changes right there. Okay, now it's hard to see and understand what he's talking about in the quote, which is why I gave it to you like this, so that you can actually what? See it for yourself. All right, so let's go to verse 42. Verse 42. And when he was 12 years old, so this is 1557, and when he was 12 years old, they went up to Jerusalem after the custom of the feast. 1560. And when he was 12 years old, and they were come up to Jerusalem after the custom of the feast. So there's a change there that I missed, right? There's a little bit of a wording difference between the 1557 and the 1560. All right, so I told you that after a while my eyes kind of go sideways trying to compare all this stuff. All right, let's look at verse 43. So we also have a spacing issue there that we got to fix, so that they're not. I try to keep everything on the same lines so that they're easy to look at as much as possible. Let's look at verse 43 in the left column. And when the feast was ended, as they returned home, the child Jesus abode still in Jerusalem, unknowing to Joseph and his mother. Let's look at the 1560, verse 43. And had finished the days thereof, as they returned, the child Jesus remained in Jerusalem, and Joseph knew not, nor his mother. Okay, so are there some wording differences there between verse 43 in the 1557 and verse 43 in the 1560.
You missed home.
Which one?
43, they returned home.
Okay, so that would be a strike, right? So the word home is missing. I contemplated, Ernie, putting that word in, but with a strike through.
Oh.
Because it's the word home is here, but it's not where? There. How many of you think I should add that in with a strike through?
I think so. It's different.
So make a note of that, and we will get that done. So those are the kind of choices that I have to make. But you're right, Ernie. The word home is here, but the word home is not in the 1560. In a little while, we'll compare this with the King James. But so right now, all we're trying to do is understand the two different versions, the two different renderings of the Geneva New Testament. That's all we're doing, is trying to understand this, all right? Verse 44 on the left column. For they suppose he had been in the company, and therefore went a day's journey and sought him among the kinsfolk and acquaintance. Verse 44. But they supposing that he had been in the company, went a day's journey and sought him among their kinsfolk and acquaintance. So the only difference there is the addition of the word what? Supposing. Okay. One more. One at a time so I can see what you guys are talking about. Who, Amy, what were you saying?
In the 1557 it says the kinsfolk, and in the 1560 it says their kinsfolk.
Okay, so that's a change. You need to underline that.
Or it's changed to what? The first word.
Yep.
And then straight through, and therefore.
Where?
After the comma.
Yeah, you're right. That should be strike through that too. So you get a sense now of the level of revision here. Okay. So Sylvia, once we have this column fixed, then what I will do is I will copy it into the other columns. So if you just worry about editing this part, in the next section where we look at this then compared to the King James, I will swap that out myself. Okay. Verse 45, 1557. And when they found him not, they turned back to Jerusalem and sought him. 1560. And when they found him not, they turned back to Jerusalem and sought him. Is it identical? All right. Verse 46. And it fortuned after 3 days that they found him in the temple, sitting in the midst of the doctors, both hearing them and posing them. Verse 46, and it came to pass 3 days after that they found him in the temple, now with a capital T, sitting in the midst of the doctors, both hearing them and asking them questions. So you can see how in this one, posing them at the end goes to asking them questions. Here it said, and it fortuned after 3 days. Here it says, and it came to pass after 3 days. The temple here is capitalized. Here it's not. So things like this, capitalization on temple versus not, is an issue of orthography and spelling and what words should be capitalized and what words should not be capitalized. Okay? Yeah.
There's different punctuation as well.
Yeah.
On the capital T, on the temple, do you see a significance there? I mean, is it a proper temple?
I would say, well, I mean, there's the Jewish temple. But like this is a real sort of thorny issue for a lot of people, right? For me, now the one on Spirit, that to me is that is a potential problem. But stuff like this, I'm not totally sure what I think about that. I don't think that's changing anything. Anybody who's reading this knows what temple it is, whether it's capitalized or not.
And King James went back and it's not capitalized.
Yeah. So there's these. So that's what that shows you is, you know, disagreement about the orthography of English words and how words should be spelled and what words should be capitalized. Okay. The same thing's true. Like even in the 1611, the 1611 King James Bible will capitalize like a word like angels. Later on, in later editions of the King James, that's not capitalized, unless it's talking about a specific angel, right? So some of this stuff, there's some gray areas when it comes to some of these things. But what I'm saying is we're just noting the changes, right? That's what we're doing. Verse... Now, listen. I understand that there might be a certain element of tediousness to this. But it is absolutely essential that we understand what is going on here, because a lot of people are making false claims about the King James. How the King James came to exist, what the process of the King James translators was, all sorts of things are being said that aren't necessarily true by advocates and defenders of the King James. So one of the things that I am very cognizant and aware of as we go through these things is to really dig into what's going on, all right? In almost every one of these things that we've looked at here so far, the only one of them that to me might impact the substance of a verse is the one about whether or not the capital S on Spirit should or should not be capitalized. Most of these are simply different ways of saying what? The same thing. Okay? What one are we on? 47.
Just one thought would be the capital T might refer to the original Jerusalem temple versus all the outlying temples that were later assembled.
So the problem, the issue with that is in the context of the passage, it's clear that they went to Jerusalem for the Feast of Passover to worship at the temple, which would have been the temple in Jerusalem. So even if you capitalize T or don't capitalize T, that doesn't change what else is said.
But I'm just thinking maybe the text is signifying that it's the temple as opposed to anybody's.
I see what you're saying, Bart. I think, though, that in the context of the passage, that would be clear to anybody reading it, whether this is capitalized or not. And as Mike has pointed out, the King James is going to choose to then uncapitalize the T and put it back to like what they had here.
Right.
So.
No, it's not significant. I don't think it's significant. I'm just saying maybe that's the original why it was done.
Verse 47 on the left. And all that heard him marveled at his understanding and answers. On the right, 1560. And all that heard him were astonished at his understanding and answers. The wording change would be from marveled to were astonished, and then there's a comma, and there's a comma here at understanding in the 1557 that is not here in the 1560. I don't really, we can get so nitpicky with this. I'm mostly interested in wording, words. The capitals I'm good with, stuff like that. Again though, had English grammar changed so extensively, hang on, let me finish my point. Had English grammar changed so extensively in 3 years that this is like, that this would have been a massive deal to these people back then? I would say probably not. Has it changed even more between 1560 and 2021? Even how many of you guys have noticed that even in some of these quotes, when I'm quoting from Daniel, he has single quotation marks around a quote? You see, you don't notice stuff like this, right? In America, we have how many? If I'm quoting, I use two what? Quotation marks. What's the difference between the single quote and the double quote?
One's a parenthesis.
No.
Single is within.
So that's the way we would do that in the United States. But the reason he's doing this is because Daniel is a Brit, and this is the way they do it in Britain. This is the way we do it in the United States. So even within English grammar today, in the 21st century, is there difference of opinion between the way the British and the English use grammar and the way the Americans use grammar? Another example is I subconsciously change some of this stuff, but let's say you have a quote and the British put the comma after the quote, Americans put the comma inside the quote.
That's new since
probably some of you guys were in high school. Okay? Yeah, I mean, so my point is, like, people can sometimes get so myopic in their view that they can't see the forest through the trees on a lot of this stuff. And they get bogged down in a lot of things that to me are not really that significant. Okay? But there is, let's go to verse 48. And when they saw him, they were astonished. I see we missed another one here. And when they saw him, they were astonished. And his mother said unto him, Son, why hast thou dealt with us? Why hast thou thus dealt with us? Behold, thy father and I have sought thee with heavy hearts. So let's look at 1560. So,
underline the and they versus when they.
I mean, that's a change. Look at the other column, the 1560. So when they saw him, they were amazed. So we need to underline amazed because that's a change from astonished, right? And his mother said unto him, Son, why hast thou thus dealt with us? Behold, thy father and I have sought thee. And now we have the word very, with very heavy hearts. So you have a qualifier in there now, underlined here, that wasn't in here. The word very. Verse 49. They said unto him, How is it that ye sought me? Wist ye not that I must go about my father's business? 1560. Then said he unto them, How is it? So how spelled different, but still how. How is it that ye sought me? Knew ye not that I must go about my father's business? So there's another one that I missed. Wist. Where'd it go? Wist here comes to what?
Knew.
I'll look in the house. Circle that and let remind
me. Father's is capitalized. Yep. Well.
Yep. So again, you know, punctuation. Verse 50. But they understood not the words that he spake to them. Verse 50, but they understood not the word that he spake to them. Word versus words. 51, and he went with them and came to Nazareth, so that's the old spelling of Nazareth, and was obedient to them, and his mother kept all these sayings in her heart. Then he went down with them and came to Nazareth and was subject to them, and his mother kept all these sayings in her heart. And Jesus increased, or verse 52, and Jesus increased in wisdom and stature and in favor with God and man. And then the next column, and Jesus increased in wisdom and stature and in favor with God and man. It's exactly the same, right? So, even in these examples that we're looking at here, and you can see that I missed more than I thought I did. I knew I missed some, but like, I'm serious. You sit down and it's like, because then you gotta like look them up, and I'm trying to compare them back here and look here, and it's not the easiest thing in the world to do. So is there slight revision here? There is slight revision here.
In the last verse 2, it goes from man to man.
Yes, you're right. Missed that one too. See? You guys need a different teacher, okay?
It's easy to do.
So, if you look underneath, as noted above by Dr. Daniel, the marginal notes from Luke 2, 40 through 52 remain virtually untouched in the 1560 Geneva Bible. In lesson 126, we observe the following regarding these marginal notes. So if you guys look back through this, you will see that there are notations, right? So let's go up here. The first one is right here, this star sign at the Feast of Easter. If you look at the quote, in the inner margin at the star are Exodus 12, Leviticus 23, and Deuteronomy 26. And at the quotation sign, for doctors, on doctors, where'd it go? I just saw it. Right here, in the margin, it said, or learned men. In the outer margin at H, so scroll down and look at verse 49, if or look at verse 49, you'll see the H here on whist. The margin says, our duty to God is to be preferred before father and mother. And at the I in verse 50, where it said, understood not the words, the margin had, for his vocation was not yet manifestly known. So all of those marginal notes are essentially exactly the same in the 1560 as they were in the 1557. There's only one change. Look at the next point. The only difference is the marginal note. The only difference in the marginal notes on this passage is the 1560 reduces the note for the star, and it is reduced from Exodus 12, Leviticus 23, and Deuteronomy 26 to simply Deuteronomy 26 verse 1. So they took out two of those references and they just left it with the Deuteronomy 26. That's the only difference in the marginal notes between the 1557 and the 1560. Okay, now, is everybody following this? So because I missed some stuff in the one that we just went through, let's go to page 3. There'll be the same things I missed will still be there. So what Sylvia is going to do, if you guys look at the center column, this is the same information that we already looked at up here. I just copied it down and put it into this table. So what I want to look at this table now is the 1557, the 1560, and then what?
King James.
The King James. Okay? So now we're going to look at yet another layer of comparison to see, okay, well, how much does this text change now between 1560 and 1611? Is everybody following that? Okay? So I'm at the top of page 3, and I want to read that quote. Going a step further, Professor Daniel comments on the similarity between the 1560 Geneva text for Luke chapter 2 verses 40 through 52 and the King James as follows. Quote, the King James panel kept closely to the 1560 Geneva, that the King James panel kept closely to the 1560 Geneva can be seen at once. Effectively, the only change is the new phrase in verse 46 asking them questions. Please consider the following table comparing the 1557 and 1560 Geneva New Testaments with the King James reading for Luke chapter 2 verse 40, verses 40 through 52. Now, we've already compared this one with this one, right? So now what we want to do is we want to compare this one with this one. So are there slight changes between 1557 and 1560? So now what we want to do is we want to try to understand the changes that are introduced between 1560 and what? 1611. All right?
One question.
Yep.
The Geneva, was that an English translation of what the Catholics had done in Italy? Or where does
no.
Geneva fit in?
So in previous lessons we talked about the history of the Geneva Bible. It was done in Geneva, Switzerland. Because by English exiles of the reign of Bloody Mary. So these are Englishmen.
Swiss-speaking English?
No, by a community of English exiles who left England to...
I thought it was another translation in English.
This is done by Englishmen into English, and they are there because of the reign of Bloody Mary. She's persecuting these guys, and they escape. Okay?
Trying to make it more easily read by the English of the day, would that have had any influence on the translation work? Because I heard that even like Shakespeare might have been involved.
That's definitely not true.
Oh, it's not.
Shakespeare had nothing to do with the King James Bible. In fact, all the biblical quotations or allusions in Shakespeare's plays, they all come from the 1560 Geneva Bible. Shakespeare was not involved with the King James Bible. And the King James translations, the King James translators are very interested in how their work would sound when it was read out loud.
Right, that's what I was hearing.
Yes, that's true. That to me is absolutely true. In fact, the final stage of the process was an audible read. So they had, the thing had gone through the committees, it had done all of its stuff, and then the final revision committee met at Stationer's Hall. And somebody stood at a lectern like this and just read the text out loud to a panel of about 9 men who had been a part of the process. And they just sat and listened to it unless somebody objected to the way something sounded.
Right.
And then if they would raise their hand and they would object, and then they would have a conversation about it and decide, do we need to change any of the wording, or are we good with the way the wording is? That's the final.
Yeah.
Now, but that is a uniqueness of the King James in that they're very interested in how it sounds when it's read out loud. Yeah. Not so much, you know, even to the sense of keeping older forms. Okay, like these ETHs. So let's see. Let me see if I can find an easy one here. Yeah, they keep that. If you go in your notes, just drop down to page 6 quick. Look at, so I'll, for the sake of those watching, I'll scroll down to page 6. So, to Bart's question, look at page 6, this table on page 6, and let's look at verse 3. So the King James says, "And though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, and though I give my body to be burned and have not charity, it what? Profiteth me nothing," right? So the word profiteth has the extended verb ending ETH on it, right? Well, let's go over to Tyndale. What did Tyndale have? Profiteth. The King James did not invent these extended verb endings. They go all the way back to Tyndale and before, right? I mean, you're looking at it right here. This is the Tyndale text from 1534, and it, on all of these verbs, it has the extended what? It has the extended verb ending ETH, right? Well, what the King James is doing, in regular English, by the time you get to 1611, they were already moving away from using these extended verb endings. But the King James keeps them because of how it reads when it's read out loud with versus without the extended verb ending. The extended verb ending keeps the rhyme and the meter that is there in English that is lost if you drop it. Okay?
So everyday language back in 1611 didn't have all
the King James Bible was not written or translated in everyday English. It is using forms and features that were already falling out of common popular use. But they keep them in the text because of what we're talking about right now, the way they enhance the flow of the text when it's read out loud. Okay, I mean, just think about this. Think about this passage. Look at all the extended verb endings in 1 Corinthians 13. For though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels and have not charity, I'm become a sounding brass and a tinkling cymbal. And though I have the gift of prophecy and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and though I have all faith so that I could remove mountains and have not charity, I am nothing. Right? Verse 4. Charity suffereth long and is kind. Charity envieth not. Charity vaunteth not itself, is not puffed up. Doth not behave itself unseemly, seeketh not her own, is not easily provoked, thinketh no evil, rejoice. Look at all of those extended verb endings in there and how that just sounds to you when it is read out loud. Okay? But again, so there's two points on this that we need to make sure that we're clear about, okay? Number one, the King James did not invent this because it goes all the way back to who?
Tyndale.
That's number one. So when the King James uses that form, are they using an old form? So already almost 100 years old or more when they use that form in 1611, right? But they keep it because of the way it sounds when it's read out loud. Okay? Now, to Shakespeare, to the point of Shakespeare, I do want to say, while Shakespeare was not involved in the translation of the King James Bible. He was not on the committee. He was not involved in it. He is indirectly involved in the following way. All right? What is the English Renaissance known for? It's not known for its paintings. It's not known for its sculptors. I mean, you think about the Italian Renaissance in Italy. You think about all of the Ninja Turtles. Raphael, Donatello, Leonardo, all those guys, right? You know that the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles are named after Renaissance artists. Well, now you really learned something edifying today, okay? But they were sculptors, they were painters, they were all of these things, right? What is the English Renaissance known for? The English Renaissance is known for its literature. It was a literary culture that Shakespeare was heavily involved in, right? So these guys had an ear that was tuned to the auditory of language. So when they sit down to make the King James Bible, this is the culture that they're reared in, and this is one of the things that matters a lot to them as they do this. Now, none of that's in the notes, but hopefully, you follow what I'm saying, though?
So the English language was at its apex.
Right in this time frame. And I'll say this too. So if you take a high school English class right now in 2021, they still will probably go through a play of Shakespeare. Be it Hamlet or Macbeth or Romeo and Juliet or something, they will go through a play of Shakespeare, right? Let me say this. Shakespeare's plays were never intended to be studied. They were always intended for the stage. They were never intended for you to just sit there and read, you know, a Tu Brute and all this stuff, right, and be like, yeah, that's great. They were always meant to be what?
Entertainment.
They were always meant to be acted out. All right? So In that age, in that era, this is the culture that these King James translators are coming to age in. So they're aware of the power of the English language and its oratory. And so they're very much dialed into that when they sit down to do their work. Okay? All right, so any other questions about that? I'm sure you have them, but I'm going to ask you to hold them until we get to that point. I got a whole lesson plan just talking about that. All right, where are we at? Page 3?
Yeah.
Okay. So let me just say something to you guys. I'm going to, when I'm done with this lesson, like we're done with this and you can study the rest of this on your own, because I want to move on to the next point about the Geneva Bible. But let's make some comparisons now between the King James and the Geneva, the 1560 Geneva, all right? So look at verse 40. So I'll read the middle column first and then the right column. The child grew and waxed strong in spirit and was filled with wisdom, and the grace of God was with him. Okay? Now look at the King James. And the child grew and waxed strong in spirit. Notice that spirit goes back to what? We definitely need to underline that, right? Because remember we talked here that this could substantively impact the text, right? Now what does the King James do? It brings it back to a lower case. And the child grew and waxed strong in spirit, filled with wisdom, and the grace of God was upon him. Verses, and the grace of God was with him. Does everybody see that? Next verse, verse 41. Now his parents went to Jerusalem every year at the feast of Passover. King James, now his parents went to Jerusalem every year at the feast of Passover. Is it the same?
Yeah.
Verse 42. And when he was 12 years old, and they were come up to Jerusalem after the custom of the feast. Verse 42. And when he was 12 years old, they went up to Jerusalem after the custom of the feast. Is it exactly the same? Verse 43.
No, it's not the same.
What did I miss?
They
were come versus they went up.
And left
up. Yep. You got those, Sylvia?
No, because I was looking at Passover and the one before.
Passover should be lowercase p.
For King James?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, it should be?
It should be, yeah, that's my mistake. Verse 42. Middle column. And when he was 12 years old, they were come up to Jerusalem after the custom of the feast. King James. And when he was 12 years old, they were come up to Jerusalem after the custom of the feast. Verse 43. And had finished the days thereof, as they returned, the child remained in Jerusalem, and Joseph knew not, nor his mother. King James. And when they had fulfilled the days, as they returned, the child Jesus tarried behind in Jerusalem, and Joseph and his mother knew not of it. So, are there clear wording differences between verse 43 here and verse 43 here?
Yes.
Are any of them substantive?
No.
None of them change the content of the verse. Okay? None of them change the content of the verse. Verse 44. But they supposed, middle column, but they supposing that he had been in the company, went a day's journey and sought him among their kinsfolk and acquaintance. King James. But they supposing him to have been, there's one there that I missed, to have been in the company, went a day's journey and they, so there's a they there that's not in the other one, and they sought him among their kinsfolk and acquaintance. Again, is the King James a minor revision? Does the King James appear to be here a minor revision of the Geneva? All right. Verse 45, middle column. And when they found him not, they turned back to Jerusalem and sought him. And I missed some stuff here too. And when they found him not, they turned back again, so that's not there in the middle, to Jerusalem, seeking him. How did I miss that one?
It's easy.
Jeez, but it's so easy to miss. When you have three columns like this, and you're trying to compare across all three, that's why I have you guys to fix me. Verse 46, middle column. And it came to pass 3 days after that they found him in the temple, capitalized, sitting in the midst of the doctors, both hearing them and asking them questions. King James, verse 46. And it came to pass that after 3 days they found him in the temple. So, Mike, I think we need to leave that capitalized because it was capitalized in the 1611. Yes.
Okay, how about doctors?
I believe doctors was capitalized also in the 1611, but I will check. Okay? But you can see a wording. So there's, again, some minor things there, right?
What was the significance of the doctor
thing? It's the idea of it being it was spelling convention at the time in 1611 to capitalize anything that was perceived to be like proper.
Now, the doctors weren't referring to medical doctors.
No. Doctors of the law, the Pharisees.
Yeah.
Verse 47 in the middle. And all that heard him were astonished at his understanding and answers. King James, and all that heard him were astonished at his understanding and answers. Is that one identical?
Yeah.
Where?
Astonished.
That's the old spelling of astonished. It's the same word.
We should have a big conference on the difference between astonished and astonished.
We should. We can have Rodney come teach. Well, but all his numeric stuff doesn't work. It only works in a King James Bible, and it only works in a specific edition of a King James Bible. Anyway, I don't want to get into all that. Thanks, Ernie. Appreciate you bringing that up. Verse 48, middle come. But it's true. Are you telling me that in almost all of these verses that anybody that had a 1560 Geneva Bible didn't have the Word of God?
That's what you have to come up with logically if you go by their argument.
I mean, I will show you some things in a 1560 when we get to a certain point that I think did need to be fixed. But by and large, if you read a 1560 Geneva Bible today, would you be far better off than reading an NIV? Absolutely. Okay. All right. So, do we need to go any further? Or do we get I guess we should to finish the. You guys finding my mistakes. What I need somebody to do seriously, is to go through all of these and find everything I missed. So who's going to volunteer to do that? Don't everyone raise your hand. Because I know there's probably others that I missed. I'll be patient. All right, so do we need to go through any more of these or do we get the point here? So if you look at page 4, again, there's just a ton more of examples. Now, if you go to the next page, I went even a level deeper so that you could see on these passages. So here's Luke 15. We went a level deeper to show how Tyndall had it, how the first Geneva New Testament had it, how the 1560 Geneva New Testament had it, and how the 1611 had it. And what you'll find in almost every case, right, is the King James essentially the same with, is the King James essentially a revised version of Tyndall? That's why when we went through Tyndall, I said Tyndall wrote the rough draft for the King James what? Okay? So you can look at page 4, 5, 6. You can see all of the different examples there. There's a long example with all of 1 Corinthians 13 on pages 6 and 7. And then let's just for the sake of time go to the conclusion. I think we've seen enough examples to get the point, right? So, and we'll hit home here on a few of these points in the conclusion. So, the New Testament as found in the 1560 Geneva Bible was a slight revision of the previous 1557 New Testament. I think we've seen enough examples to prove that beyond doubt. Okay? So as we think about this, look at the next point. Studying the textual facts found in the translational history reveals conclusively that God did not dictate the English Bible to the King James translators. That absolutely did not happen.
If he did, he must have done it for the previous versions.
If he did, he would have had to done it for the previous ones too, because are they all essentially the same? At least in the New Testament, the stuff we've looked at here in these examples. So, studying the textual facts found in the translational history reveals conclusively that God did not dictate the English Bible to the King James translators. So when you hear people say, so I'm leaving the notes for a second, when you hear people say things like the following, that the translators could read and speak and meditate in Greek, and that they knew all of this stuff, and they knew all the nuances of the Greek and all this sort of thing, that might be true. It probably was true that they knew Greek better than I do, or, you know, probably too many people that are alive today, right? But they weren't just sitting at a table waiting for God to impart to them on high what the Word of God should be in English. They are literally using all of the stuff that we've been studying in this process as a way of determining what the reading should be. Okay? Rather, the translators followed the rules set forth by Bishop Bancroft to govern the process. In doing so, they used previous English Bibles to inform their work. This explains why the King James New Testament is 83% the work of who? Tyndale. Okay? So, I'll end with this. Double inspiration is a false doctrine that does not accord with the textual and historical facts or a dispensational understanding of the Scriptures. Statements such as the following are dangerous and need to be repudiated. Quote, yeah, the originals were inspired, but you know what? The Holy Spirit controlled every word that came down on this book, pointing to his King James Bible. Oh yeah, there's men out there using the sleight of men and dishonestly handling the Word of God. They're out there. Listen, if you say that the Holy Spirit controlled every word that came down on this book pointing to a King James Bible, how do you not conclude that that person is saying that the King James translators were what? Inspired. You following that? What we're seeing in this process, it's in going through this process, is that that's absolutely not the case. It's not. So, stuff is being said out there, you know, and I'll just be honest, who said this? Scott Ray said that in his video, that your faith should not stand in the wisdom of men. And he's talking, when he says there, yeah, there's men out there using the sleight of men and dishonestly handling the Word of God, who do you think he's talking about? He's talking about me. He's talking about me because I happen to believe that all this process that we're going through explains how we got our English Bible.
It was a process,
right? And another thing I want to end with before we go, this, if you, everybody turn in your Bible to Psalm 12. I made this point before, but I'm going to make it again. Psalm 12, verse 6 and 7. And I'm going to make it in this lesson as it relates to what we're talking about the Geneva Bible. The words of the Lord are pure words, as silver tried in a furnace of earth, purified how many times?
Seven
times. Thou shalt keep them, O Lord, thou shalt preserve them from this generation forever, right? You can have a super mystical understanding of preservation that thinks there's something magic about the number seven. Right? Purified seven times. Tyndale, Coverdale, Matthews, Great, Geneva, Bishops, King James. Seven. King James has to be what? The perfect one, because it's the seventh, right? But wait a minute. Tyndale went through three editions. The Geneva Bible went through at least two editions. At least, probably three before we get to 1611. The Bishop's Bible went through at least two editions before 1611. So which edition in this magic seven math, sevenfold math argument are we supposed to count? You follow what I'm saying? Arguments like that don't work. All of this verse is saying, how pure are the words of God? How pure are they? They are as pure as silver tried in a furnace of earth, purified what? That's a simile. The words of the Lord are pure as silver tried in a furnace of earth, purified seven times. How pure are they? They're that pure. They're as pure as silver tried in a furnace of earth, purified seven times. When David wrote Psalm 12, he wasn't talking about an early 17th century English Bible. He was talking about the words he was writing right there in Hebrew while he's writing under inspiration, and God would preserve those words. And how pure were those words? They were as pure as silver tried in a furnace of earth, purified how many times?
Seven.
And God's going to preserve them. So when you take the Hebrew Masoretic text and you open it up to Psalm 12, 6 and 7, and those words are still there, did God do what he promised and preserve his word?
Yes.
All right, we got to quit though. I got to pack up and get all this stuff situated. So I'm going to end the video.